Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The other day I realised that every time I think to follow John Masefield's emotion and head to the sea, I find that it's not lonely at all. It has a way too much to be at, looking after itself and those who sail on her. But still, I love the suddenness of his desire. I must go down to the sea again. And of course, when he gets there, he really wants to see a good, tall ship. In Cloverhead, you want to see a seal. They were away for a while when the new harbour was being built, and arriving at the pier wasn't so surprising then. You'd miss the languid laziness of them, peering up at you with one eye closed, taking or leaving you, depending. In County Clare, you want to see the Merryman and the Willie Clancy men and women diving optimistically in for the swim, having ordered the hot whiskies for interval time, if they survive the cold heart grip of the sub-zero thundering waves. In Dunleary, you will always want to see a ferry for the history of it. My, what people have left through the open-mouthed doors of its boats, some of them for short times, some forever, some sadly, some with a spring in their steps. I used to get that call for London and its bookshops and its friends, and I knew there and then that what I had to do was make my way to Dunleary to get to the boat. I must go down to the seas again, for the call of the running tide is a wild call and a clear call that may not be denied. What is it about boats leaving harbours that makes us tingle? A ship is really a bus. An aeroplane is a bus that flies through the air, just as a hat would if it caught on the wind at a wedding, say, or the races. A ship is a bus on the sea. So what is the difference? Well, for starters, you get longer to look at a disappearing ship. It takes its majestic time about pulling out and turning around like a peacock to give you a different view and then ploughing on purposely into the horizon. My, do we like our transport. The bar in Dublin Airport was once a place you went on dates. People drove to see the new Ballygally roundabout on the Monaghan side of Auchnacloy. And don't tell me that no one ever found a kind of love at it. Paul Muldoon certainly did. But a leaving boat has a life all of its own. It's the whole picture that does it. The sea fills us with longing, even though we may not know for what. The colours of it, green, silver at dawn, different shades of blue, black, sometimes even red if you've got a brazen sunset. It makes us wonder, how big is the ocean? The thought of that makes us go silent and want to jump in. You wouldn't do that at Ballygally on the Monaghan side of Auchnacloy. Standing on the harbour brings the departers to mind. Diaspora doesn't have a cut-off point. And out of sight, out of mind, wins the beat over that talk of absence making the heart grow fonder. I fancy a job drawing suitcases. How they have grown and styled up. And what on earth is that about wheels? Good plan, though. I think of the people going through, the unnamed and the big names. Mary Lee, for one, so big that nobody knows it. She left in 1879, came down from Monaghan, a bit south of Ballygally, and watched Dublin fade as she made her way to South Australia to go get women the vote. I spent a month on a ship in her footsteps, never even having seen a boat before I put my foot over the pier. It lodged the longing in me forever, so I am apt to act on going down to the sea again. Although, to be absolutely honest, I have no desire whatsoever to repeat the experience. In much the same way as it took me years to use CIE after travelling from Kathmandu to London by bus. The best part of ship sailing may well be standing on the pier watching them go. And if thinking about emigrants and the watching the leaving gets too much for you, you can always turn landwards and look at the people walking the pier, telling each other secrets. I must go down to the sea again, where no one will hear what I am saying.
They fished the bonny shoals of herring from Dunleary one time too, but that was the time before I got there. Late one summer I got there, sore in my heart from schooling, thoughts of a conventional job, the need to try something, well, something else. So I went to the coal pier, where the trawlers berthed, and joined the seagulls waiting for scraps on pier side. The trawlers lay three deep on the bobbing harbour, and I was told by an old fisherman mending nets to make my way to the outer trawler and hurry, because Donoghue needed a cook but wasn't hanging about. Across I clambered, swinging from deck to deck, the Jim Hawkins of Dunleary. But Donoghue was no Captain Trelawney, rather a skipper from Killoglan, with a butt in the corner of his mouth, who fished mostly out of Howth. Rough as you like. Piercing eyes, few words. Have you fished prawn, lad? No, not prawn. Can you cook? A bit. He gave me a list. Go up to H. Williams, bring that down. So my first catch was landlubber produce in a cardboard box. 10 sliced pans, 5 packets of sausages, rashers, eggs, sugar, tea, milk, food to keep hunger away from 5 prawn fishermen 2 nights at sea. It was evening now, wind rising as we chugged out between the piers. Yachts were flapping back to port, and I hadn't a clue what to expect. Apart from the manning of a 2-ring corner stove on 3 legs, 2 bashed-in frying pans, a kettle that was teapot also. Cook up, lad. It was an unsteady dance I jived that evening in a cramped galley with my partner, the 3-legged stove, my hips bruising against wooden fittings. I burned the fry and was relieved of my duty by the skipper. He gets heartburn, I was told by one of my crewmates. He always takes over the cooking. I was sent up on deck. Where were we? No land was visible. A heavy board on chains was lowering into the sea. Nets dragged behind. Light was leaving the sky. Get some shut-eye, Donoghue said, as soon as the nets opened out. And he'd set the boat on a course above fishing beds he knew better than old Kerry roads he'd travelled as a child. It was hot in the cabin, creaked of timbers. A suffocation of diesel fumes put me to sleep. But it seemed only 5 minutes had passed when Donoghue was bellowing, "Get up, haul her in." The net was winched out of the sea with a sucking gurgle, an agitating bundle from the deep. It hung momentarily above the deck. The next string was pulled, out poured the catch in the moonlight, a grey horde that slithered about our boots. Dogfish were thrown back where they'd come from. Other fish were sorted and boxed. Cod, plaice, ray, lots of ray, monkfish, mackerel. Donoghue threw sausage and egg sandwiches at us. And we set to work on the real catch, Dublin Bay prawns. Sitting on stools on deck beneath the light of a single bulb, we topped, in other words, beheaded, those curious little top-coloured crustaceans so that they could go directly to Cordon Bleu restaurants. Now, among the men, the talking began. One was Skerries, the other two Ringsend. But I didn't get to know much about them or about their doughty skipper. The talk was of fishing, but not of prawns. It was of herring, the shoals of herring, of catches that swelled whole fleets out there on the fishing banks, of how boats had chased those shoals, but how the shoals had drifted like shadows beneath the waves, deserting them. There was still money being made on herring, but not in Old Dunleary. Now, if you wanted to catch a cran, you had to go to Dunmore East, but that was down in the middle of nowhere, down in the sticks, they said. A pity. Herring was the silver darling. No topping involved. No sitting on deck. No sores between fingers. Gogs between thumbnails. Instead, until next catch you could go back to Blanchestry. I listened for most of 3 hours. Until, task completed and dawn in the east, the call came from Donoghue in the wheelhouse. Shut eye. Another 5 minutes sleep then, so it seemed, and the routine repeated. On deck again, discard the dogfish, sort the saleable fish, rasher an egg sandwich this time, top the prawns, another 3 hours on the lore of the Bonny Shoals. Each third daybreak, for 4 weeks, we slipped into the low harbour behind Howth's Head. We landed prawn for the continent, mended nets, drank in the Abbey Tavern. And what did we talk of? The Bonny Shoals of herring. Then a morning broke and we were chugging into Dunleary, our hold too ice tight with the catches of the previous nights to navigate back around Howth Head. Donoghue went up to the Bank of Ireland, returned, money in his pockets, divided our shares among us, and that was the day I slipped away from the trawler. I had a notion to venture south to Dunmore East, of the herring shoals. Old trawler men watching from the sloping gardens by the seafront would point out to me where the shoals were journey bound. But would I recognise them, those silver darlings migrating beneath the waves, those shadows nudging through the seas of fishermen's hearts?
Swimmer for Milo. He was diving as if his life depended on it. And from where we sat, lording it over the slow tide and morning mist, recall the swallow dive, the soaking pads of his feet, the back flip, the outrageous belly flop that brought us up short before, like a veteran, he lapped up the last of the sun on his face, the curious night music of cicada and olive trees whispering about the silent hours, a shuttered house.
When I remember the Dublin of my childhood, a storybook opens. It seemed that you were living in a compendium of stories, an anthology, a tarot pack of narratives. You walked the streets of Yeats and Pierce, of Brendan Behan and Philip Linnett, of bold Robert Emmet, the darling of Erin, and James Plunkett, and Luke Kelly, and Zosimus, and Nuala O'Fualon, and Patrick Kavanagh, and Maeve Brennan, and Mary Lavin, and Bob Geldof, and Lady Gregory. As a young person, that's how I felt. All these storytellers were my neighbours, each of them attempting versions of perhaps the same thing, singing from the same dark hymn sheet. We lived in a coast town. The stories came and went, raucous as Dublin Bay's seagulls, which descended on the People's Park in squadrons. The Mariners' Museum in Dunleary spoke of heroic pasts, wide seas. On the pier, you sensed the ghosts of all those multitudes who emigrated, who watched the steeples of my hometown recede into memory. Taken on a school trip to Kilmainham Jail, you were enthralled by the story of Grace Gifford, who had married Joseph Mary Plunkett the night before his execution. If you went to see The Virgin Prunes, you would hear lyrics written by Oscar Wilde now screamed with the punk fury of the era. Philip Chevron's band, The Radiators from Space, had been saturated in the city's literature. With titles like Faithful Departed and Kitty Ricketts, it was as though Joyce had discovered a Fender Telecaster guitar in some foul rag and bone shop on the quays. No other city in the world had rock music like this. In London, Johnny Rotten was snarling of anarchy. In New York, the Ramones were setting fire to guitars. But in Dublin, Gavin Friday was quoting the Ballad of Reading Jail as he made with the eyeliner and the rouge. We had renegades, but they defied even the conventions of rebellion. We didn't do three-chord tricks. But then our street songs and ballads had always been short stories. Touching, scabrous, satirical, tender, as alive to the stench of the eddying Liffey as to the possibilities of truth and beauty. It was a world of tough survivors, of jacks of all trades, of whores and paycocks and fishwives and chancers, skeptics who had more in common with the braggadocio of the Chicago blues than with the tweedy jollities of sanitized Irish folk music. Molly Malone, Dicey Riley, Biddy Mulligan, the Twang Man, who were the real people that had inspired these strange fictions? Our history itself was told in ballad form, which is to say that it was told as a set of carefully worked fictions. Kevin Barry, the Spanish Lady, Matt Talbot in his chains. Chaucer never invented darker characters. Father Holly, The old priest who taught me English for the Intercert had once seen Maud gone crossing O'Connell Bridge. And when we came to Yeats's line that she had beauty like a tightened bow, Father Holly paused and looked down at us with episcopal gravitas before saying, "I saw her, boys. Yeats was right." Other teenagers might read that poem and wonder about the Troy it attempted to burn, but Dublin adolescents knew we were living there. Joyce, Shaw, John Singh had walked the seafront at Dunleary. And there were summer evenings when their spirits seemed to hover as you queued for an ice cream at Teddy's or walked the breezy expanse of the pier. Mangan and Stoker had inhaled the stench of Dublin. Swift had preached the gospel in the Liberties. Statues of Burke and Thomas Davis stood sentry over the streets. Poets had led the 1916 revolutionaries. O'Casey had brilliantly stolen the rags of English Victorian music hall sentimentality and draped them around a stinking corruption. Not for nothing, perhaps, was the greeting of Dubliners an understated question. What's the story? Where are we now? One figure abides, the Easter Island god of Dublin writing. The city of his Ulysses is long dead now, but somehow the ghost of Joyce still wanders Dublin, drifting the starbucked streets. It would surprise him that these days you can't smoke in a pub, but you can buy a condom and a croissant in a petrol station. The strumpet city he immortalized is a shadow place of contrasts, a provincial Edwardian backwater throbbing with lust and enmity. It has crusty elegance and pitiless squalor, the desolation of a scandalized diva reduced to the dole. His fellow exile, the hawk-eyed Samuel Beckett, regarded Dublin with bleak amusement. It may be glimpsed in his scathingly hilarious novel Murphy, especially in the dying wish of its glum protagonist that his ashes be flushed down the public toilet of the city's Abbey Theatre, if possible during a performance. But comedy is tragedy in fancy dress. The decades following independence and the restoration of Dublin as a national capital saw hordes of the local wordsmiths wisecracking their way into print. Flann O'Brien's At Swim Two Birds celebrated the juiciness of Dublin's speech. Drink fueled the crack, but also the bitterness, what Yeats called the daily spite of this unmannerly town. John McGahern is justly celebrated as the laureate of rural Ireland, but many of his exquisite short stories are peopled by characters who see Dublin as a maze of possibilities. McGahern conjures a town of tatty dance halls and uneasy courtships, of kisses in damp doorways and unfulfilled hungerings. His Dubliners are stalwarts of the city's rural-born workforce who take the first bus home to the countryside on a Friday evening and the last one back to Bedsitland on a Sunday. Their flings and farewells make for writing of extraordinary grace. Anyone who has ever lived away from home will find bittersweet beauty in his pages. McGahern's work acknowledges that Dublin, like capitals everywhere, is a community of migrants with conflicted loyalties and tastes who are not always doing what the authorities think. Indeed, I remember the moment around Christmas 1987 when I realized that Dublin fiction had changed forever. Roddy Doyle's The Commitments ripped up the rule book. No dark-eyed Colleens, no descriptions of rain, no unnecessary adjectives and no guilt. It was no longer possible to recycle the other world that had appeared in Ulysses, that melancholy little London of gaslight and parasols that had for so long seduced Irish writers. These days, younger Dublin writers are less place-specific in their preoccupations, dazzling stylists more than traditional storytellers. And some of the most exciting writing is being done in other parts of Ireland. A new country is unfurling around us. There's a lot to look forward to, less looking back. But on Dunleary Pier at night time, the past can feel close as absence becomes a presence again.
If ever you go to Dublin town, in 100 years or so, inquire for me in Baggot Street, and what I was like to know. Oh, he was a queer one, Fald Al the Dido. He was a queer one, I tell you. He was a queer one, Fald Diggadoodai. He was a queer one, and I'll tell you. My great-grandmother knew him well. He asked her to come and call on him in his flat, and she giggled at the thought of a young girl's lovely.
Clinging the Clig. Clinging the Clig Ravi and the Boyd Sillish at our anchor is the Huan. By the Hulamid never shook a lure, a mach and kay. A gehe uch the rote, a lore and lay. Shulamid less mud than down cusk, keg of will stirrum, or boggart, is capini bona, ervor in the down. Ta suham mahins and ishke, is trasna an chuin, bein eidir a craha a chín gomagúil o si chún. I vadwin a gír na spéire, tá lung trí crown, rod nef gan áha gomá. Dermse gur bé mananán a tá ag marciach da capel ar vacarí bláfar a riachta. Is nach fada go dúcar se suascuin, is fí roig an vacamare an rian, des le mucamara a gudach a néwig Egenach and Rasil. Gore meet Bert. And ni meet Gamahan score. Or Sauliak the dull, the hop, skip, Kasabakoid, our spare in the Harriachta. Haran Gnahulicht lehul. Tandriacht the score our sule, mile hoor, solo. And ish fain last year dean, the speaking the saw pale, a sheeny drone the spare, like a scallo on grain. Tá halla an dhile a gailú fena éilcloch léháin, is na tithe lóistín is spréocharnaigh fena nahana mí sláán. Leagan an rairc a machme, leagan fós an spréocharm a lasan in nainas do gáthúil vór. Tugan mo chrí éin freabhbheag é drórach a bháin, fad a clingan na clig rávi ar na báid. Agus anis an taistruchan e mírle a yinis hain. Cénach ein aistruhor mame. The bells ring out. The warning bells ring out on board the lightships that are sitting at anchor in the bay. While we stroll nonchalantly out the east pier, eating ice cream cones already at midday. We walk outside the wave break, though a storm is threatening with white caps on nearly all the rollers. There is quite a swell in the sea, and across the water, Hoth is shaking its head in a wistful gesture. Away on the horizon lies a three-master, a sight so strange, I say it is Mananon out riding his white horses over the pastures of his kingdom, and that soon he will ask us if we had seen the porpoises stolen from him at the fair of High Brazel. We both laugh. We understand well the score, our imaginations going hop, skip, and jump beyond the range of the possible, beyond the scope of the mundane quotidian. We see magic before our eyes every hour of the day. Even now, the church spires rise up to the sky and glisten whenever the sun shines. The town hall is sparkling in its old limestone facade, while the B&Bs are painted in every possible candy shade. The sight takes my breath away. So too does the glint that shines in your two eyes of blue. My heart swells in a little faltering cascade as the warning bells ring out on the lightships in the bay. Gramagar. Thank you.
Today's edition of Sunday Miscellany Live marked 200 years of Dunleary Harbour. It was recorded in the Pavilion Theatre in 2017 and was supported by Dunleary Rathdown County Council. The scripts today were The Wild Call by Evelyn Conlon, Bonnie Shoals of Herring, which was by Leo Cullen, Swimmer, a poem by Gerald Daw, Storytown was by Joseph O'Connor, and Cling in the Clig, The Bells Ring Out, a poem in Irish and English by Nuala Ní Gonal. The music was Prelude, Opus 32, No. 5 by Rachmaninoff, played by Conor Linehan. The Road Home was composed and played by Martin Turish on accordion and Triana Marshall on harp. Sailing Boats by Alec Roth from his quartet Paul Clay Pictures, performed by the RTE Contempo Quartet. Patrick Kavanagh's If Ever You Go to Dublin Town was sung by Barry Gleason. And lastly, The Seventh Degree, played by Triana Marshall on harp and Martin Turish on accordion. And that piece was also composed by Martin. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And if you'd like to find out more about the programme, go to rte.ie/culture.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.